Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson, we love guitars.
Welcome to another podcast at slysoffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Computer Works and Jeff's Guitar Clinic. Joining us now, Associate Editor of the Capital Times and Correspondent for The Nation, John Nichols. John, anything going on in the news, or should we just wrap this up?
Yeah, it's funny. I think
Your dog agrees.
My dog says he always wants to be a part of the conversation. He's developed a terrible habit of barking whenever I'm doing an interview, which I think he thinks... I actually know exactly what it is, because to shut him up, I give him food, and so... I made the exact wrong mistake.
You do a lot of interviews. You do a lot of interviews. You're gonna have a fat dog.
Yeah, speaking of mistakes, you asked if anything was going on, and it's funny that I was asked this morning that exact question. So, is anything going on this early? And I said, yeah. Aside from the collapse of the global economy, and as a result of a pandemic that, you know, countries around the world, including the United States, have not dealt with in serious or responsible ways. No, nothing.
Other than that, everything's fine.
Yeah, things seem to be going great. I mean, we're literally right now, Sly. The only way to say it is we are actually now living in what they, not that many years ago, they made movies about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here is the president over the last few weeks talking about what we're facing now.
It's a little like the regular flu that we have flu shots for, and we'll essentially have a flu shot for this in a fairly quick manner.
It's going to disappear one day. It's like a miracle. It will disappear. Yes. And from our shores, we've, you know, it could get worse before it gets better. It could maybe go away. We'll see what happens. Nobody really knows.
This is their new hoax. But, you know, we did something that's been pretty amazing. We're 15 people in this massive country, and because of the fact that we went early. We could have had a lot more than that.
And the tests are all perfect. Like, the letter was perfect. The transcription was perfect, right? This was not as perfect as that, but pretty good. I like this stuff. I really get it. People are surprised that I understand it. Every one of these doctors said, how do you know so much about this? Maybe I have a natural ability. Maybe I should have done that instead of running for president.
Maybe so.
People are really surprised by what he knows about this. It's getting more amazing by the minute. And I thought some of the most striking surprises came in the minutes after his speech to the country last night. Probably, I don't know if you'd say it, but I would say the most consequential address of his presidency, right? I mean, I can't imagine.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of it.
Yeah.
Now we must take the same action with Europe. We will not delay. I will never hesitate to take any necessary steps to protect the lives, health, and safety of the American people. I will always put the well-being of America first. If we are vigilant and we can reduce the chance of infection, which we will significantly impede the transmission of the virus. The virus will not have a chance against us. No nation is more prepared or more resilient than the United States. We have the best economy, the most advanced healthcare, and the most talented doctors, scientists, and researchers anywhere in the world. We are all in this together. We must put politics aside, stop the partisanship, and unify together as one nation and one family. As history has proven time and time again, Americans always rise to the challenge and overcome adversity. Our future remains brighter than anyone can imagine. Acting with compassion and love, we will heal the sick, care for those in need, help our fellow citizens, and emerge from this challenge stronger and more unified than ever before. God bless you, and God bless America.
So, we're the most prepared?
Well, no. Might I just suggest, first off, quite a bit of what he said there was pretty honorable. You know what I mean? You know, I give him his due.
What if he meant it?
Yeah, well, and I just had this feeling that it didn't really sound like him. You know, it sounded like maybe there was a little preparation went into this. And if you looked at the seriousness with which, or, you know, kind of the pained look with which he was delivering it, you know, it's kind of one of those moments where it looks like maybe the White House tried to pull together and, you know, do something right. And that would be encouraging if it wasn't for the fact that in literally the seconds after the speech, agency after agency after agency, the federal government was sending out urgent alerts as regards to things the president got wrong, literally wrong about his own policies in the speech. And the question is, how do you do that? I mean, literally, I ask that honestly. How do you give the most important speech of your presidency and clearly put some effort into crafting the language, compassion and love, things like that, and get huge swaths of what you're talking about wrong?
You know,
in a way, by the way, that caused panic in Paris. The airport was packed with people. There's reports of, you know, airline prices going through the roof.
Right. He didn't contact the... He didn't tell the EU that he was going to do this.
Right. And then, by the way, also caused panic as regards anybody involved in global trade, because he was talking about cargo and stuff like that. He's talking, you know, human beings, but also, you know, trade. And the things he was saying were not accurate.
Oh, and then he excluded Great Britain, which has a higher rate than some of the countries that he included.
Yeah, look, the whole thing was, you know, this had the scent, if you will, the signal, the flash of Stephen Miller.
Mm.
Didn't it sound a little bit like
yes,
that?
Yeah.
We're going to shut off.
Yeah.
We're going to shut off anybody coming from anywhere, and we're closing down trade.
We're closing
down everything.
Do you think this president know that he's done? Like, he's finished?
No, I absolutely will promise you he does not. That's not how this guy thinks. As you know, as has been evident again and again. Now, I do think that I've always believed that Donald Trump kind of operates on two levels. It's like the outside bravado and the inside sort of unformed person. And these are always at odds with one another. I think his bravado goes up when he's more tense, when he's more concerned. And there have been reports, you know, in lots of news outlets, that inside the White House he's blowing up all the time. He is quite furious with CDC folks who are giving necessary warnings. He is furious with the stock market because it didn't do what he tells it to do. And I do think that he's manifesting behaviors of somebody who knows there's a lot of trouble, that this is really serious, and probably, quite frankly, he's not up to it, and that the people around him are not up to it. And the weird part is that Joe Biden, who often gets, you know, picked on for his own gaffes or flaws, he was on with Lawrence O'Donnell the other night, and he actually said something profound, and I think quite right. He said it very calmly, and he said it with all the due apologies. I'm sorry to have to say this about a president, but if he just wouldn't speak, if he would just let the experts speak, you know, kind of stand back and say, we do have the greatest people. We have a whole lot of people who really know how to do this stuff, and I'm going to step back and encourage you to listen to the CDC, encourage you to listen to the people who do deal with economic issues, encourage you to listen to public health folks, encourage you to listen to folks who worry about poverty in this country and about the barriers to health care, which now could become not merely a problem for an individual, but problems for everybody. You know, just we should have the experts up front. And that you know, I'm extending a little bit from what Biden said, but making this point. And you know, that after last night's speech, as we're looking at what's happening, you know, today, and the speech was on Wednesday night, we're talking on Thursday morning, there's an awful lot of evidence that if he hadn't spoken, that a lot of things would be better. You know, it wouldn't be that all the problems would be solved.
Right.
But it would simply be that he introduced problems and challenges. And I honestly, Sly, I don't think that was his intent. I think his intent was to stabilize things.
He just doesn't know any better. And he hasn't got the A-team around him. So, you know, during the impeachment trial, when all the people from the diplomatic corps and the State Department came forward, and the Republicans were systematically trashing these public servants, the same has happened with scientists and the CDC over the last 3 years. This attack on people with intellectual capacity has become, it's really been a problem with Republican presidents for a very long time. It's just that it manifested itself exponentially with this president to an incredibly different degree. We're paying the price for that now.
Well,
in so many different ways.
You're right. And the climate, you know, a whole host of economic issues, and now literally the health and safety of the country. And somebody, I think it was Ron Klain, who had been involved with, you know, a lot of
Ebola.
And in the broader sense with pandemic concerns in previous administrations, said, you know who's actually quite good at dealing with something like a pandemic or an epidemic or something that requires a lot of expertise and a lot of seriousness and a lot of connections and abilities to get stuff done? The deep state.
Indeed. Here is another real treasure for Wisconsin, Glenn Grothman, congressman from the 6th Congressional District, who's from Glen Beulah, Wisconsin, interestingly enough. Actually interviewing yesterday Anthony Frucci.
Okay. Based upon the current trajectory, how many people do you think will get this new virus, and how many people do you think will die?
I cannot predict. And that's,
I know you can't predict, but there must be, we have a graph. We have the beginning of a graph. We know this is going to go up. We have the experience of China. We have the experience of Italy.
Yeah.
Can you give us some projections?
It is going to be totally dependent upon how we respond to it. So I can't give you a number. If we now sit back complacently...
I'm not asking to be complacent. I'm asking for a realistic... I mean, that's what the public is looking for.
I can't give you a realistic number until we put into the factor of how we respond. If we are complacent and don't do really aggressive containment and mitigation, the number could go way up and be involved in many, many millions. If we taught to contain, we could flatten it. So there's no number answer to your question until we act upon it.
I'll give you a question. You know, nobody talks about, you know, every night they play, like, I don't know, 8 to 10 NBA games, and nobody talks about shutting them down. Is the NBA underreacting?
We would recommend that there not be large crowds. If that means not having any people in the audience when the NBA plays, so be it. But as a public health official, anything that has large crowds is something that would give a risk to spread.
I think inadvertently, and I don't think that was his intention, Glenn Grothman got the NBA shut down.
Well, he kind of opened up the discussion
right?
in a proper way, and more power to him. And I was surprised he didn't ask, well, you know, I know you can't give big numbers and all sorts of predictions, but what does this mean for people who live in their mom's basement? You know, or stuff like that. But Grothman, look, I know people don't often mock Grothman. The truth of the matter is what he was asking there was not, you know, he was pressing, trying to get some numbers, and I understand that. But it is fascinating.
But he didn't quite understand the concept, though.
No, it's clear he didn't. And as was once said, I think, by Roman Hruska, one of the senators from the Dakotas, you know, that's sort of the genius of representative democracy. You actually have people in positions of power who, you know, really don't know a lot of stuff and ask questions that may not be particularly informed.
Well, Glenn has focused much of his career on ending Kwanzaa.
Yeah, I realize that.
And stopping a post office from being named after Maya Angelou.
Glenn is a remarkable American Wisconsin contribution to our public discourse. But, you know, as they say about a stopped clock, it's twice in a day. And in this case, bringing up the NBA, you know, and discussing it was quite appropriate. And And so, you know, if you just play the right part of the clip slide, you know, he sounds pretty good.
All right, we'll take a break. John Nichols from the Capital Times with us at sliceoffice.com.
I want to welcome a new sponsor to sliceoffice.com. The attorneys at Gingrich, Thompson, and Wachs have had the honor of receiving numerous awards for their work both in and outside the courtroom. But just as important as receiving accolades for being skilled attorneys, it's equally important to give back to the community in which they live and work.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
We're back at sliceoffice.com, brought to you by our friends at the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, Madison Teachers Incorporated, and Madison Firefighters, Local 311, as well as the Operating Engineers, Local 139. All right, let's get to the race for president that is still going on. Maybe we're not having rallies, but the race continues. Let me ask you about this story right here.
Facing pressure from some Democrats to drop out, one-time frontrunner Bernie Sanders tonight vowing to keep fighting.
Today, I say to the Democratic establishment, in order to win in the future, you need to win the voters who represent the future of our country.
But Sanders' young supporters did not turn out in force.
Last night, obviously, was not a good night for our campaign from a delegate point of view.
And it's delegates that count. With Sanders losing every county in Michigan Tuesday, which he won 4 years ago, and Missouri, plus a Biden landslide in Mississippi, it's almost impossible to catch up. Biden reaching out to Sanders.
I want to thank Bernie Sanders and his supporters for their tireless energy and their passion. We share a common goal, and together, we'll defeat Donald Trump.
In 2016, Sanders did not endorse Hillary Clinton until just before the Democratic convention. Democratic strategist James Carville says Sanders should quit now.
Let's shut this puppy down and let's move on and worry about November. This thing is decided.
And this from a top Sanders supporter.
There's no sugarcoating it. Tonight's a tough night.
But Sanders' aides think he can beat Biden in their first head-to-head debate Sunday, and that a Biden gaffe could change the race. Meanwhile, Biden is acting like a nominee, planning a speech tomorrow on how he would handle the coronavirus.
All right, and then here's Jim Clyburn.
Quite frankly, if the night ends the way it has begun, I think it is time for us to shut this primary down. It's time for us to cancel the rest of these debates, because you don't do anything but get yourself in trouble if you continue this contest when it's obvious that the numbers will not shake out for you.
And that we don't.
All right. So, your thoughts.
Look, at this point in a presidential race, everybody's got a right. And I would dare go further to say a responsibility to offer their view. It's fine to have people say it should finish, it should go on. And you make credible arguments all over the place. My sense on it is this, and I go back to really in many ways for me the definitional presidential campaigns, the ones where I sort of started to, I think, understand things in a deeper way were those of Jesse Jackson in the 1980s, in 1984 and 1988. In both of those campaigns, at a very early stage, it was quite clear that Jackson wasn't going to be the nominee. By the start of April, after having had some really big breakthrough wins, in some primaries and caucuses, Jackson had, I think from April 1 until, the end of the process, he lost 15 primaries and caucuses. He won two in Delaware and the District of Columbia. And so, it was clear that the nomination wasn't there, and yet he carried on. And I just always make the point that in carrying on in 84, he got the Democratic Party to do what it should have done decades earlier and take a firm stand against apartheid and in favor of sanctions. In 88, they expanded that. They opened up debates about all sorts of issues that had not been opened up. They really expanded out the membership of the DNC to be more diverse. They made rule changes that actually ultimately became relevant decades later in the Obama-Clinton race of 2008. And so I think going on, carrying on, if you do it in the right way, even if your chances are remote, even if it's very, very difficult, is a very healthy thing, and it can do a lot of good in the moment and toward the future. But there's also one other element here that I think is significant. I hear a lot of pundits on TV talking about, oh, this thing's gotta be done, right? And my sense is the people can figure this out. We've got a primary schedule. Sanders has suggested a big debate on Sunday, and where you really do talk about electability. He's frankly given Biden lots of opportunities to step up and talk about the things that Sanders has put on the table.
Well, he actually did Biden
a bunch of primaries right after that.
He actually did some debate prep for Biden.
He telegraphed, basically. Here's what he did, and I think this is the way to understand it. You can't get in a guy's mind, but essentially, this is what it looked like. He gave himself an exit ramp, right? He gave Biden an entry ramp. And essentially, we don't know where exits and entries might occur. It might go to the convention, might happen sometime earlier. But essentially, he said, the nominee of the party has to address a whole bunch of issues, which are very, very popular, and which a lot of centrist Democrats have not accepted. Also has to reach out to especially these young voters. He's saying that if Biden reaches out to these young people who are coming into the process, and in some cases being turned off to the process at this point, that's going to go a long way toward convincing not just Sanders, but the people who back Sanders, that there's sense in kind of uniting and coming together. But if Biden doesn't do that, if he doesn't, then he essentially telegraphs to not just Sanders, but to Sanders' supporters, that the job isn't done, that there still needs to be debates and there needs to be a discussion about some of these fundamental issues, and it can and should go on. And the weird part is, again, we have all these people trying to tell Sanders what to do, just as last week you had all kinds of people trying to tell Elizabeth Warren what to do, as if Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders have the power to kind of deliver everybody who is supportive of them or sympathetic to them. Foolish calculus.
They're foolish because, you know, the truth is, and here's something that really isn't discussed much, but every poll that I've seen is that Biden and Bernie actually share some voters.
A lot of voters. And there's quite a bit of evidence that Biden's second choices are Bernie, and Bernie's second choices are often Biden, more than people might imagine. Although I think that we actually saw that starting to play out, where a lot of those Bernie second choices went to Biden on Super Tuesday and in Michigan, Missouri, and places like that. But going forward, we actually have a real-time test of all this. Why? We don't need the pundits to tell candidates what to do. Voters will do it next Tuesday in Arizona, a state where, you know, if Sanders' work in the Hispanic community is realized, he might still run quite well. In Illinois, the state he almost won last time, in Florida and Ohio, states where he has, you know, much harder climbs. If Sanders does well next Tuesday, and what is well, I mean, obviously that's a readjusted measure, probably, considering some of what's happened. But if he's getting, you know, substantial numbers of delegates, then there's clearly a big chunk of folks who would like this race to continue. And don't tell them, the Democratic Party would be wise not to tell them that they're wrong.
Comparing 2016 and comparing 2020 is difficult because the circumstances of the two elections are very, very different. We're dealing with an incompetent, corrupt president who has, and we're in the middle of a crisis. So it's hard to compare, but it is evident that a lot of people voted for Bernie Sanders in 2016 because they clearly didn't like Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And yet we also see in the exit polling that some of Bernie's ideas are pretty darn popular within the Democratic primary voters. Can you sort that out?
Sure. It's not hard. And here's the bottom line on it. There were some people who were sexists, right? Weren't going to vote for a woman. And that ought to be stated right up front. There were other people who didn't like Clinton because they don't like the Clintons, right? And they didn't like some of the politics that Bill and Hillary Clinton over the years had
Right. Or they didn't like dynastic politics, period.
Yeah, all those things come into play, yeah. Right? So, but we should never underestimate the sexism. We should never underestimate, you know, personalities and all that stuff. And so if we put that in one place, and then also put in another place, you know, kind of where Biden is and, you know, who he is personally and his personalities. And then we also, you know, look at his ties to, you know, the Obama administration, which is quite popular. You know, these are all parts of the mix. But at the heart of it is this question of issues. And the fascinating thing is that in Michigan, a state that Sanders really would have liked to have won, worked very hard in, and did not win, 57% of people said they favored his signature issue, which is Medicare for all, single payer. And the fascinating thing about it is they didn't say they favored it in the, you know, kind of gentle, happy talk, sloganeering way. They were asked, did they favor essentially a government-run program, healthcare program, that replaces private insurance? I mean, you can't get blunter than that, right? I mean, it's the absolute, you know, bluntest way of saying it. 57% are for it. It's an overwhelming victory. It's a landslide victory for it. And then in Missouri, where Sanders lost by more, it was 58%. And then in Mississippi, where Sanders lost by even more, it was 60%. And so here you have a guy whose signature issue is hugely popular, and he's not winning. Well, how do you sort that out? It's not hard. Go to another number in the exit polls, and that is the numbers on a question. As regards your presidential nominee, the person you're going to vote for, do you want somebody who agrees with you on the issues, or do you want somebody who can beat Trump?
All right.
Exactly how it was worded. And the fact of the matter is, Bernie Sanders isn't losing the ideas primary. He's losing the beat Trump primary.
All right. So here's the rub, and I don't know if many people saw this, but in the interview you referenced earlier in this conversation with Lawrence O'Donnell and the former vice president, Lawrence O'Donnell asked about the coronavirus and the pandemic that we're facing, and Bernie's saying, hey, this is a prime example of why we need Medicare for all. And I will tell you, and not just because I support Medicare for all, the vice president didn't do that well in answering that question.
Oh, he did horribly. And yeah, it wasn't quite as bad as some people heard it, right?
He needs to work on it.
Yeah, let's say some people heard him saying, yeah, he'd veto it, right? The truth is, if you kind of listen to the language, it was sort of classic politician dodge where, you know, he said, well, I'd veto anything that made things worse, which, you know, yeah, I think most of us think presidents should veto things that make things worse. But it seemed to be a suggestion in answer to that direct question that he might think that Medicare for all would make things worse. And so he desperately needs to address this issue, because the fact of the matter is, if he is a guy running for president saying he's against Medicare for all, right, that he thinks it would make things worse, then that changes so many dynamics, because I don't think Medicare for all is quite there yet, but my sense is that Medicare for all is becoming an issue very much like trade was in the 1990s into the 2000s, where you had a huge number of Americans who understood that our trade policies were wrong, that they were failing, and that we needed to make a big change. And that became something people, you know, understood intellectually and emotionally and practically. They just saw it. And my sense is that Medicare for All is becoming that kind of issue. Maybe not everybody's on board, but more and more people are, you know, kind of coming to understand the necessity, especially in a moment like this with coronavirus, of moving in this direction. And if Biden is a wall against that, if he's like, oh, no, I would never do that, that's deeply problematic. Not because people are going to switch over and vote for Donald Trump, but it's just because it becomes harder to mobilize.
Finally, Jennifer Rubin from The Washington Post, one of your faves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She wrote a column yesterday calling Bernie selfish.
Selfish.
For not getting out of the race.
Oh, yeah. That's always the old argument, isn't it? Right? That, you know, it's all about you. And you're doing this for yourself.
And you know the truth is? I don't think he is.
Oh, my gosh. Quite the opposite. I can tell you this. Bernie Sanders got into the 2016 race early on because he desperately felt that there were a set of issues that needed to be raised. And he and others were waiting for Elizabeth Warren to do it. She chose not to run, and so Sanders stepped up. I don't think he ever expected that the issues would prove to be as popular as they have turned out to be, that the movement he created would prove to be as significant, both in for his own campaigns, but also for transforming the party. Sanders is a movement guy. He's into this idea of, you know, moving the needle, advancing the issues, building the structures that might make fundamental change. And the notion that this is a selfish act, I can only tell you it happens through, you know, being at events and things like that. I've been around Bernie Sanders with his grandkids. He adores those grandkids. He loves representing Vermont in the U.S. Senate.
Well, you remember, he can be a little gruff. He's not always the most charming person in the world. He doesn't really like small talk.
Nope.
But when we were at the concourse and he showed up a couple years ago, and I'm sure
I remember that.
Do you remember how his demeanor changed when the young staff that were union workers at Madison's Only Union Hotel came in? And they talked about how the union helped them and what they were doing in their jobs. Do you remember how his demeanor changed?
And I've seen it in other settings too. That was great there. I was with him a couple of years ago on the Mexican U.S. border, right? No cameras. He was just touring the border and talking to immigrants and environmentalists and public health people and civil rights people. You know, he's one of those big roundtable thing. I've rarely ever seen a political leader who so immediately subsumed himself to the discussion, right? Didn't come in and make a big speech, but quite the opposite was like, well, what do you say? Well, I don't get that. Tell me how that works.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's a really good idea. You know what I mean? This whole kind of, this very collaborative thing. And I have enough respect for Jennifer Rubin to wish that she would, you know, maybe get out of wherever it is she's hanging out and go out and look at the reality of people when they campaign, and, you know, who actually is perhaps the least selfish candidate. And if she gave it an honest look, I think she would conclude that it is very probably Bernie Sanders.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.